Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
In a few years, we'll have to find a whole new language for race. No more minority scholarships, no minority rights groups, no minority leaders. That's because whites will no longer be the majority.
Virtually every white supremacist in America has the year 2050 very much imprinted on his or her brain. The Census Bureau has predicted that that is the year that whites will lose their majority in this country.
Blacks will outnumber whites. Latinos will outnumber blacks. Maybe our ideas about race and power will be bad dreams of the past.
The fiction, the romance, and the technicolor dreams. Black and white.
Or maybe whites will go from being the majority with most of the power and preferences to the minority with all the same things. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, March 11th. And John, you're down in Florida. I'm back in New York. We just heard Mark Potok from the Southern Poverty Law Center talking about an issue that a lot of people who think about race are going to have to think about a lot more in the future.
Just call me Whitey. Whitey. That's me. I'm down here live at WLRN, our member station in Miami, Florida. And let's begin with the top story this morning, which is all about education in those very changing demographics, Celeste. There's a sweeping new move to set higher standards in our nation's schools. Yesterday, governors and school chiefs released a blueprint for K through 12th grade instruction. It calls on states to teach specific topics in each grade level, replacing present guidelines, which vary wildly from state to state. Dane Lynn with the National Governors Association tells NBC News,
"We can't wait any longer to close the achievement gap. If we don't get more students, and particularly students of color and from low-income families, into college, the U.S. economy is not going to survive."
The White House supports this plan and promises federal money to states who adopt it. But a big obstacle right now for our schools is the lack of funding. Last night, Kansas City School Board members voted to close half of that city's public schools because of a $300 million state deficit.
President Obama can see the finish line in the year-long battle to reform health care.
It's time for an up or down vote in Washington on health care reform. Tired of talking about it. Let's get it done.
Speaking in St. Louis yesterday, the president said he'll show the final details of the bill to Democrats at a meeting later today. Also on Capitol Hill, the Senate overwhelmingly approved a bill that gives months of continued jobless checks to people who've been out of work for more than 6 months. But that costs money, of course, and the government has now run up the largest monthly deficit in history. The Treasury Department says the February deficit totaled more than $220 billion. That's 14% higher than the previous record set in February of last year. And new projections this week say this could be the year the number of babies born to minorities in America outnumbers babies born to whites. We're going to be talking about what that means in our ideas about race in America. And we're joined now by Maria Hinojosa. She's host and managing editor of Latino USA. Good morning.
Good morning.
So we actually have already seen this happen, at least in states like California. Do we know what kind of impact we're seeing, say, in California, where whites are already in the minority?
Well, essentially what it's done, Celeste, is it's turned our image of our country upside down. For young people, what it's done is it's opened their eyes to see that there's no difference between them and any other quote-unquote minority. But for others, it has completely blinded them and set them up with an image of fear of what happens in the future. But essentially, I haven't used the term minority for decades. Well, it looks like that's the way it's going to be for the rest of the country.
Okay, stay with us, Maria. We'll be back with you in just a moment. We want to get this conversation started with our listeners as well. How do these labels work in your life? And in what way do you identify as a minority? And how are you part of the majority? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post to our website, thetakeaway.org. Taking a look at the markets, futures are down. The Dow will start at 10,567, the S&P at 1,145, and the NASDAQ at 2,358. Coming up, we're going to get an insider's look at this year's South by Southwest Festival in Austin to see if there's any big technological developments coming out. And we're going to have more in this conversation about minorities and majorities in a moment.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
America is becoming more diverse. That is not news. But what is news is this new demographic study that shows kids are leading the way. Just under half of the children in America, less than 5 years old, are non-white. But some demographers say 2010 could be the tipping point when there will be more babies of color than white babies born in the United States. So is minority even a relevant term anymore? We're joined now by Kenneth Johnson. He's a professor of sociology and senior demographer at the University of New Hampshire's Carsey Institute. And he co-authored the report that was released yesterday on the growing diversity of America's young people. Good morning, Kenneth.
Good morning.
So can you kind of sum up what the main findings of this report were?
Well, the main findings were, as you reported, that 48% of the children born last year in the United States were members of minorities, by which we mean they were not non-Hispanic white. And the structuring of the United States' population tends to be going from youngest to oldest, so that among those 1 to 4, about 46% are minority. But among those over the age of 20, it's 31% who are minorities. And we also looked at the geographic spread of this phenomenon, and we already have 500 counties in the United States where most of the children are members of groups other than the non-Hispanic white part of the population. Another 300 are close to being in that position, and in contrast, there are only 300 counties in total in which the minority populations represent the majority of everyone in the county.
Okay, so Kenneth Johns, that's a lot of numbers. I think I've taken them all in, but does this mean that within 20 years, the adult population, whites will no longer be the majority?
Well, the population projections by the Census Bureau are that somewhere around the middle of the century, there's a lot of disagreement exactly when, but around 2050 or so, the majority of the American population will not be non-Hispanic white.
What's the gap there? If we're going to tip the point on babies this year, possibly, then why would there be 40 years before that would affect the adult population?
Well, it takes a long time for the population to change. As I said, only 31% of the adult population is in a minority group. So that all that young population has to flow up through the whole age structure before it would transition the whole age structure. Plus, it's unclear what are going to happen to immigration levels. Immigration is down a little bit now because of the recession. We don't know how many children everyone is going to have. Hispanic women tend to have about one more child than non-Hispanic white women, but traditionally immigrant groups have eventually had their birth rate slow down. We don't know how that's going to happen among Hispanics. So, I mean, there are still a lot of unknowns about exactly when this is going to happen.
You know, but I got to ask you, Kenneth Johnson, I was reading this report and there's a lot of places in which you've talked about the minority majority and the majority minority, which is incredibly confusing. Are you going to have to find a new vocabulary for talking about this, or are you planning to still use these words majority and minority?
Well, honestly, my focus is always on the numbers and the data. I admit that some of these terms are a little complicated to deal with, and I would be happy to have somebody create new ones, but I'm a demographer. I'm used to dealing with, if you think majority-minority is a tough one to deal with, you should see some of the other stuff we struggle with. So.
Okay, well, Kenneth Johnson is a professor of sociology and a senior demographer at the University of New Hampshire's Carsey Institute. Let's go back to Maria Hinojosa. She's host and managing editor of NPR's Latino USA, also an Emmy award-winning reporter with Now on PBS. Good morning again, Maria.
Good morning, or probably I should say buenos dias.
Buenos dias.
There
well,
you go.
You know, you heard Kenneth struggling over the terms to use. Are we going to have to find a place, something to replace minority?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, the interesting thing, Celeste, is that a long time ago, I would probably say early 1990s, I decided that I was no longer going to use that term minority. It went out of my vocabulary. I have two kids, a 14-year-old boy and an 11-year-old girl. They have never heard me use the term, well, we're a member of a minority group, or yeah, you're a minority. Never.
A majority lost its meaning for me living in Brooklyn, I think, years ago. And I have five kids. That's the irony here is I have five kids. You have two, right, Maria?
Yeah, John. Well, you know, obviously you were busier than I was, but hey, you know.
But I actually delivered my 8-year-old to a birthday party this week, and it's not the first time where she was the only white girl at the party.
Yeah, and so here's what's fascinating. I mean, this change opens up all kinds of, like, wonderful possibilities. I was walking through a park near my home in Harlem, And I was with my daughter, and in front of me there was clearly a Latina babysitter, nanny, with two little white girls. And as we approached them, the Latina nanny was speaking to the little girls in Spanish, and the little girls were answering her in English. And I was like, wow, that is so cool. You have a mom who made a decision to hire a Latina nanny and tell her, I want you to speak Spanish to my kids. And they're open to it. On the other hand, there's the whole element of fear and, oh my God, if whites are a minority, we know how minorities are treated in this country. It doesn't look so good for them.
Well, let me ask you that question, and let me go back to the question I posed at the top of the show, Maria. As whites become the minority, does that mean there will be an automatic shifting of power, that the preferences that we're seeing that will move?
Well, I think that what we have to recognize is that this is going to be a power struggle, and that's what makes it kind of hard and ugly in some places. But, you know, what's joyful about it is that, on the one hand, you can have Dora the Explorer, which, of course, Huckenberry's kids have seen. All of them have seen Dora the Explorer, like mine. They grew up looking at this little brown-skinned bilingual girl, and the little girls are saying, I want to be like Dora. And the little boys are saying, yo quiero ser como Diego. So on the one hand, you have, and she's the largest-selling children's character ever in history, billions of dollars. So on the one hand, you've got that, which is really cool. On the other hand, you have, well, our friend Lou Dobbs, who was paid $8 million after he was fired, but he's still on the radio. And what he has done consistently is to paint an image of this Latino person. I mean, it's an undocumented immigrant who he's talking about, but basically people just see Latinos now as a threat to everything that America stands for, our language, our culture, our demographics, our jobs. So you've got these two things happening at the same time. How it's going to play out, I think it plays out one-to-one. People talking to each other and, you know, getting over this question of fear.
Okay, Maria Hinojosa is the host and managing editor of NPR's Latino USA, obviously a subject that we could talk about for a very long time. So, Maria, I'm going to ask you our takeaway question today. We're asking our listeners how these labels fit in their lives. Do you consider yourself to be part of majority?
I'm a human being, I'm American, and I'm really hopeful about our future as people have lots of babies. I think that means hope.
Okay. You can give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or post to our website, thetakeaway.org. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in now on the top headlines.
Back to Washington, where there still is a white majority, that's for sure. Democrats say they are getting close to a final vote on the health care bill. Congressional leaders and administration officials moved closer to working things out in a meeting last night. The vote can't come quickly enough for President Obama, though.
It can't be if, it's got to be when. We are going to get this done, and we're going to get it done soon.
Democrats still need a final cost estimate from the Congressional Budget Office. The foreclosure crisis isn't over, but it may be slowing down realty tracks as the number of households facing foreclosure in February grew only 6% from a year ago. That's the smallest increase in 4 years. But Realty Tracks' Rick Sharga says foreclosure levels still remain high.
The fact that we're looking at over 300,000 households getting a foreclosure notice as being something of a relief suggests that we're perhaps getting a little bit numb to the level of activity we're really looking at.
And that level of activity could increase again as thousands are currently being considered for loan modification programs, and some of them could end up losing their homes.
Abroad, Chile's new president, Sebastián Piñera, will be sworn in later today. He faces the task of rebuilding the country following last month's earthquake. And finally, the richest person in the world, not Bill Gates this year. It's Mexican telecom tycoon Carlos Slim. First time someone from a developing nation tops the Forbes list of billionaires. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, America may be getting browner, but baseball still predominantly white. We are going to have comments on that from our sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. He's going to tell us why the fires of race have been burning brightly lately.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our takeouts begin live from Miami. We're in South Florida in the studios of WLRN in Miami. We begin with the voice of Ibrahim Abdelmateen, takeaway sports contributor up there in New York. Good morning, Ibrahim.
Good morning.
Fellow Brooklynite.
Indeed.
I thought we'd continue that pretty fascinating discussion of race that ended there with Marie Hinojosa talking about how as the demographics shift, there's a tendency for some groups to maybe cling to power, and we certainly see that in our politics. In sports, this transition has happened really over many, many decades, right?
It's true. That's a good point.
I mean, African Americans are the majority in basketball, have been for a long time. It's odd to note that whites are still the majority in baseball.
It's very true. And actually, yesterday we heard some interesting points about this from Torrey Hunter, who's a center fielder for the Los Angeles Angels. Did you see that, John?
Yes, indeed.
So he said basically that people see dark faces out there, and the perception is that they're African Americans. And then he goes on to say, they're not us. They're imposters. And then he says, even people I know come up and say, hey, what color is Vladimir Guerrero? And Vladimir Guerrero is a player on the Angels who plays with them. He said, is he a black player? And he says, I say, come on, he's a Dominican. He's not black. And a lot of people don't understand, Hunter says, that the percentage of white players in the game is down too.
You know, he's making this really interesting nuanced point, which as this majority-minority thing shifts, also the differences between individual groups come out. I mean, I was born in the 50s, and as a little boy, it was just whites and then everybody else. That's no longer the case. And how are these comments going down, if Torrey Hunter?
Well, he's actually, what he's doing is he's opening up the vault of truth, in a sense. Ozzie Guillen, who's a manager for the White Sox, he acknowledged that it was a funny context, but he said that they look for places where they have talent. And that brings up this question. Is America's pastime reflective of America, or is it just the best baseball league in the world? And as sports fans—
Well, what do you think? What do you think?
And I think it's actually both. I think it is reflective of America within the percentages, and every generation it does reflect somewhat of the American conversation and the American struggle that we're dealing with. But I think also it is the best baseball league in the world, and that's why you have players from all over the world that are clamoring to get here to play.
You know, and the other thing that's interesting, and this also is reflected in our politics in the United States racially, and that there's a labor issue involved there. Who gets the jobs? And part of what Torrey is talking about there is that, Latino, particularly people from the Dominican Republic, et cetera, there's a wide perception they're given a preference into the major leagues because of all kinds of favorable issues, talent only being one of them.
Well, listen, CeCe Sabathia and I spoke about this right after the Yankees won the World Series. And one of his main points was that in America, African-American players, they're growing up in places that don't have the space and the facilities to play baseball the way that they used to in the past. And one of the big reasons why young athletes, African-American athletes, are going into football and basketball is because there's full scholarships connected to that. If American baseball and colleges gave out full scholarships, you would see more athletes from African-American athletes playing baseball. But at this point, if you're growing up and you have a choice of going a track of getting full scholarship to school or going a full track of going to play in the minor leagues for the next 8 years, you don't even know when you're going to get to the majors, I'd go for the full scholarship.
Huh. If you were coming out of college now and had multiple opportunities, what sport would you pick, Ibrahim?
The funny thing is,
you had an opportunity, maybe football, right?
Yeah, no, I did. Well, I think baseball is the best sport to play for the longer term, and you'll sign your big contract when you're 28, 29, 30. So honestly, I think it's funny considering all this. I would probably play baseball.
All right, what position?
I'd definitely be an outfielder, and then I would be one of the 8% compared with the 28% of foreign players. So I'm African-American. I'd be one of 8% players in Major League Baseball.
The demographics of baseball from our sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdelmateen. Thanks for that.
For our last take, we look to our listeners, and their responses are...
Genius.
Of course, we're in the middle of a week-long series about genius, who is one, whether that's a blessing or a curse, how it carries pitfalls. We got this interesting take from Liz. She writes us, even in kindergarten, my son was labeled a genius. Today, he's an interventional cardiologist at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. The problem? He has two sisters who, for all of their lives, measured themselves against him and felt they came up short. Now, in the real world, these two young women are way smarter than their brother. They're what would be called street smart. So who's really the genius here? If you want to catch up on this series and share your own take, go to our website, thetakeaway.org.
And we're going to continue that conversation later on in the morning. Failure as a pathway to genius. There are a lot of great conversations to be a part of on thetakeaway.org. We talked yesterday about how the economy is delaying people's retirement plans, and that prompted a lot of stories.
My name is Terry Arnold, and yes, my retirement plan has changed. My retirement plan was at Harrison's, and my dad has lost it all. So I'll be working until I'm dead. Thank you.
This is Jack. I retired in 1994 at the age of 39 to Montana. Spent 5 wonderful years there, moved to Florida, where I was accidentally hired and continued working since. To tell you the truth, this latest recession has not affected me whatsoever or my latest plans to retire.
Lucky Jack and poor Terry there. Gives new meaning to the term exit interview, hey? But and you can see this on our site, too. We've had a lot of people saying, are you kidding me? When our guest yesterday, Duke University economics professor Mike Munger, had this advice.
What is your income? Multiply that by 16. That's how much you need. So if you're making $50,000 a year, you need to have saved
$800,000. $800,000? Why didn't I think of that? $800,000. This is Greg from Boston. I got to get to work.
You can actually see Mike Munger's response to our listeners on our site, thetakeaway.org, because he's posting his comments just like you are. Remember, folks, 800K, remember.
Finally, we told you the story of Illinois' Democratic Party opening up the nomination for lieutenant governor to everyone. We thought, hey, how would you campaign in your own state?
Hi, this is Scott from South Carolina, and I absolutely could be lieutenant governor of the state of South Carolina for two primary reasons. First and foremost, I have a passport and can travel to Argentina. Secondly, I have never been on the Appalachian Trail.
Bazing! Keep the conversations going. You can reach us at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post to our website, thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, I'm spending a second day down here in Miami getting to know our new listeners in the South Florida area here at the studios of WLRN in Miami. Also attending the We Media Conference, which is a fascinating look at the fast-forward future of all kinds of media, including the news business. Coming up, and speaking of news, Joe Biden, the vice president, wrapped up a trip to Israel this morning, gave a speech in Tel Aviv trying to mend some of the tensions that came from this visit. We'll have a full analysis of that trip in just a few minutes. But right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 31 minutes after the hour. 48 governors have come up with a plan for a nationwide standard system in our schools. Calls on states to teach specific topics in each grade level, replacing present guidelines, which vary wildly from state to state. Chester Finn of the Fordham Institute tells NBC News.
It's revolutionary if we not just agree on what they should learn, but then actually take the heavy lifts that are necessary to get them to learn those things.
One example is by seventh grade, all kids under this plan will need to have basic geometry and algebra skills. The White House promises federal money to states who adopt the plan. Trying to regain the reform mantra, House Democrats have banned corporate earmarks. The idea is to make members of Congress give up their long-cherished practice of directing federal dollars to their home districts. Republicans countered by calling for a ban on all earmarks.
The House also wants to ban misleading mailings that look like they're from the Census Bureau. This comes after some Republican groups have been sending fundraising letters labeled census document. The mailings asked for money and for voters to reveal their political stance. Overseas this morning, Defense Secretary Robert Gates says Iranian support for the Taliban in Afghanistan isn't much of a problem for the U.S. right now. Gates says that as far as the U.S. can tell, Iran's support for the insurgency is, quote, pretty limited. And here at home, the number of U.S. households facing foreclosure in February grew 6% from a year ago. But here's the good news. That is the smallest annual increase in 4 years. RealtyTrack's Rick Sharga says it's still a big problem.
The trends appear to be slowing down a little bit in terms of growth, but still growing and still going in the wrong direction.
Over 300,000 homes were foreclosed on last month. Let's check in on the markets. Asian markets are up. European indices are mixed. Futures are down. The Dow will start at 10,567. The S&P opens at 1,145 and the NASDAQ at 2,358. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
So it was a tall order, even when Vice President Joe Biden landed in Israel earlier this week to begin the highest level visit by an official of the Obama administration since the administration began. But things got tense once he was there, and a particularly ill-timed decision by the Israeli government to announce new settlements in East Jerusalem created complications. This morning, the vice president attempted to ease those tensions in a speech in Tel Aviv.
Well, it's always easier to point fingers. It's time for Israelis and Palestinian leaders to acknowledge each other's steps to heed this call, even when more remains to be done, and for the world to do the same thing.
Getting the Israelis and the Palestinians to acknowledge the positive in the stalled peace process is a challenge all by itself. Even finding those positives is maybe an even greater challenge. Heather Sharp joins us now, BBC reporter in Jerusalem. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning.
And Aaron David Miller, former Middle East negotiator in both Republican and Democratic administrations. He's also a scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., joins us from Washington. Good morning, David Miller.
Good morning.
So, Heather, just first of all, how did the vice president do? Did he address these issues? Is the question of the timing on this settlement matter put to rest, or is it still linger?
I think perhaps there is a message from the Americans that they're, in some sense, satisfied with what the Israelis have been saying this morning. This morning, the office of Benjamin Netanyahu issued a statement saying the prime minister regretted the timing of the decision and that he'd called in the interior minister to essentially give him a dressing down over the timing. And Mr. Biden said he appreciated that. And he also said he was reassured that construction on these very, very controversial homes in East Jerusalem was not going to start possibly for quite a few years. So his words were conciliatory towards Israel. But at the same time, the actual sense of what's going to happen with the indirect talks that Mr. Biden came to launch is very, very much in question.
In fact, it's off in the fringes at this point. Heather Sharp, a BBC reporter. Aaron David Miller. Heather was speaking to us earlier this week and gave in her analysis a sense that as time has gone on in the administration, the significant challenges that existed when Barack Obama was inaugurated have been compounded by a real sense of growing bad faith between Palestinian negotiators and the Netanyahu administration there in Jerusalem. Would you agree with that?
Well, the situation isn't getting any better, put it that way. But the reality is Israeli settlement activity in East Jerusalem are not. The fundamental obstacles that now separate Israelis and Palestinians on the core issues, which after all is supposedly the focus of the entire exercise, getting an Israeli-Palestinian agreement, those basic issues, the parties really are separated on all of those issues by very large gaps. And until Israelis and Palestinians are willing and able to pay the price that is required to negotiate an agreement, we're simply not going to have one. So I think the vice president he's not a Middle East envoy. He didn't come to negotiate. Paradoxically, I think he came to provide a certain measure of coordination and reassurance to the Israelis on Iran, got caught up in the inevitable tick-tock of the Arab-Israeli conflict.
So, Aaron David Miller, and then to you, Heather Sharp, BBC reporter in Jerusalem, what would we call this visit? Biden biding time, Aaron David Miller?
You know, I think the vice president, he's a very smart guy, was reminded this week of the painful obvious, the painfully very obvious that, you know, in life sometimes no good deed goes unpunished. And basically, that's going to be the message of any Obama administration effort to mediate a conflict between two leaders, Benjamin Netanyahu and Mahmoud Abbas, who are not masters of their politics, but prisoners of their constituencies. And until you have the kind of leadership, again, willing and able to pay the price, there are going to be a lot more Biden-like visits.
As we've seen many times in the past, Heather Sharp, a BBC reporter, that a period like this of sort of lateral non-movement in the peace process can be accompanied by real serious demoralization on the street, both in terms of the Arab world, the Palestinian world, and among Israelis. How are people feeling at the conclusion of this visit?
Well, I think there was a sense of that in the way that Biden chose to address the people today in Tel Aviv, the students. He said, "Only a friend can deliver the harsh truth. This is no way to live. The status quo is unsustainable." And I think on the street, there was never any great expectation from this visit. I think the bad faith has in a sense, percolated down to the people on the street. The Palestinians are increasingly frustrated when they continue to see building going on, even though there's supposed to be a freeze in the West Bank. They see the building going on in East Jerusalem. They see new things being announced. Deep frustration. There's been frustration over the announcement of the Israelis recently that they were going to put two controversial sites in the West Bank on the Israeli heritage list. And we have seen a bit of a stepping up in protest, in stone throwing. And I think on the Israeli side, there's a constant sense of, well, what are the Palestinian leaders playing at? Do they or don't they want to negotiate with us? You know, where do we go from here?
Indeed. Heather Sharp, BBC reporter, reporting from Jerusalem. Finally, Aaron David Miller, former Middle East negotiator for both Republican and Democratic administrations. The Bush 2 administration was criticized for putting the Arab-Israeli peace process on the fringe tacitly for whatever reason. Has the Obama administration kind of done that at this point?
You know, governing is about choosing. You've got an overextended, overstretched president who's shepherding through his premier signature issue, health care, presiding over a jobless recovery and two ongoing costly and very unpopular wars. So, yeah, the Arab-Israeli conflict is important, but it's certainly not the most critical issue for the Obama administration.
All right, Aaron David Miller, working on a new book, Can America Have Another Great President? Talking to us from his home in Washington, D.C. about Vice President Joe Biden's speech in Tel Aviv at the conclusion of his Middle East visit. Coming up, the South by Southwest Festival in Austin. It's all about Twitter. It's not a band.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. Well, when he won the presidency in Chile last year, Sebastián Piñera didn't know he was inheriting a problem of disaster relief. Piñera will be sworn in later today, just 2 weeks after a massive earthquake hit the central part of the country. So he may have to throw out his entire agenda and focus solely on rebuilding. Joining us now is Gideon Long. He's the Chile correspondent for our partner, the BBC. He joins us from Santiago. Hi, Gideon.
Hi there.
So tell me a little bit about this new president and what he ran on.
Well, Sebastián Piñera is a 60-year-old businessman, a billionaire, the third richest man in Chile, and one of the 1,000 richest men in the richest people in the world, according to Forbes. He made his money principally by introducing credit cards to Chile in the 1970s and 1980s, and then he made some very shrewd acquisitions of shares, particularly in the national airline LAN. That's how he's built up his fortune. He then went into politics. He's been in politics for quite some time, and he comes from a political family. His brother was a former minister in the military government of General Augusto Pinochet in the 1980s. He's moved into politics himself. This is his second bid for the presidency. He ran against Michelle Bachelet back in 2005 and lost. He ran again last year and in January this year against Eduardo Frei, and he's won. So he's been looking, angling for the presidency for quite some time, and he's finally achieved it.
Well, he is going to be a conservative turn for Michelle Bachelet, correct?
That's right, and it's interesting. This is the first time that a conservative-led government has been back in power since General Pinochet stepped down 20 years ago. So it really does feel like the end of an era, the end of 20 consecutive years of centre-left rule. And it's the first time the conservatives have gained power via the ballot box since 1958. So it certainly feels very symbolic.
What were his campaign promises?
Well, he campaigned on the economy. He's a businessman, so that's obviously his specialist area. He's promised Chileans 6% annual growth over the next 4 years, and he's promised to create 1 million new jobs, which is quite a claim, given that the workforce in Chile is less than 8 million people. So far, he said that despite the quake, he's sticking to those pledges. His other main campaign issue was crime, which has been increasing in Chile and has been an increasing concern, particularly to people in Santiago. So he campaigned on a tough law and order ticket. Again, he said he's going to stick to those pledges during his presidency, despite the earthquake.
Has he said? I mean, we heard a lot of stories about violence and looting after the earthquake. We also know that it's going to cost a lot of money for Chile to recover from the earthquake. Has he said how he's going to bring about growth, jobs, and less crime after the earthquake?
He hasn't. He's been very short on detail so far, but we're expecting that once he assumes power later today. He's holding a press conference tomorrow, and I suspect that some more details might come out as to how exactly his plans will change. But he has said that, you know, for 2 years, he and his advisors have been working up their ideas, and they've just had to rip up the book, really, and start again because of the earthquake. It's going to be a massive reconstruction effort. Having said that, I don't think it's necessarily all negative for Mr. Piñera. In some ways, this falls into his hands. He's taking power amid a scene of incredible solidarity between Chileans, as we've seen before with 9/11 in the States and with other disasters around the world. It tends to bring people together. So in some ways, he's starting with a tremendous amount of goodwill.
Hmm. Gideon Long is the correspondent in Chile for our partner, the BBC. Thanks so much, Gideon.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee, and I'm joined by John Hockenberry, who's not in New York, but in sunny Miami. Right, John?
That's correct. We're down here as part of our coverage. Taking a look, and people in Florida have certainly been outspoken on this subject. What does Haiti need right now? The earthquake in January is still causing problems in that country. We've been getting great responses from listeners at 8778-MY-DAY.
But coming up, we're going to be talking about the South by Southwest Festival, a festival that I've known of as a music and film festival for a very long time. But what many people don't know is it's also a great place to learn about upcoming tech innovations. We'll talk about that in a moment. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. A final agreement on health care may be near. Congressional leaders moved closer to working things out during a closed-door meeting last night. Meanwhile, President Obama says the bill would save taxpayers nearly $100 billion a year by making health care more efficient.
That abuse in improper payments is more than we spend on the Department of Education and the Small Business Administration combined.
Speaking of waste, a study found that as many as 30% of patients who undergo tests for heart disease probably don't need them. Researchers at the University of California looked at the records for nearly 2 million patients over 4 years.
Here's another health story. A government panel says more pregnant women should be allowed to have a vaginal birth after previously undergoing a C-section. More than a decade ago, 3 in 10 women were given that option. But that rate has dropped to 1 in 10, in part because of bans by some hospitals and physicians. The Forbes Rich List is out, and for the first time since 1994, and it's a bit of a snapshot of the global economy, in addition to talking about some pretty interesting personalities. For the first time since 1994, an American has failed to take the number one spot. Mexican telecommunications giant Carlos Slim is now the world's richest man, according to Forbes, with $53.5 billion. There are some politicians on that list, including the new president of Chile, who's going to be inaugurated today, Sebastian Piñera. He's going to be sworn in later today. He faces the task of rebuilding that country shattered by the recent earthquake, taking a page, in a sense, from Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, who came into power right after 9/11. He's also on the Forbes list. But perhaps the big story on the Forbes list, towering over all of it, is the fact that China now has more billionaires than any other country. It's not necessarily a surprise, but it's pretty interesting. Who are the new additions to the super rich in China? The BBC's Michael Bristow joins us once again from Beijing with more. Good morning, Michael.
Hi, good morning.
So who are the Chinese names and what constituencies, businesses, et cetera, do they represent? And should we get to know their names?
Well, just to go back to your introduction a little bit, I think there's more billionaires in China than in any other country apart from the United States. The United States still has far more billionaires than any other country, just over 400.
Ah.
China has 64 billionaires and 89 if you count Hong Kong. That's the former British colony that was handed back to China in 1997. Now, who are these people? Well, a large section of these people are involved in property. If you can just imagine, China over the last 30 years or so has been completely rebuilding. I've got so used to seeing cranes all over the place that it's become second nature just to see them, and I expect them everywhere I see. So obviously that's made a lot of people very rich, and about a third to a quarter of people, Chinese billionaires, are involved in that sector. But there are also other people from manufacturing. There are people like and processing, people like China's richest person, according to Forbes. That's Zhong Qingho. Now, he runs a multi-billion dollar company that makes soft drinks, and there's also someone called Li Shufu, and and he runs a car company called Geely. He started off life as the son of a farmer and worked his way up, and that company is now poised to buy Sweden's Volvo cars. So you can see that there's not just in property, there's a big range of people who make up China's billionaires, many of them joining this list for the first time.
You know, the United States is fond of its own kind of rags-to-riches stories in talking about a rise from obscurity. Is there a narrative in China that some of these billionaires have in common? I mean, do they end up hoarding their money? Do they become philanthropists? Do they enter politics? Do they become global figures?
Well, they do enter politics, some of them, because the Communist parties try to co-opt many businessmen into the system. But most don't. Most get involved in just making money. And there is a lot of rags-to-riches story. It's interesting that many of the people who are Chinese billionaires, they've started with nothing, worked their way up, and now have reached the top. Really, it's a capitalist dream here in China.
All right. Talking about the capitalist dream, the 69, is it, Michael, billionaires from China on the Forbes list just announced today. Michael Bristow, economics reporter for our partner, the BBC. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
That was the song Vaporized by Broken Bells. They're playing at this year's South by Southwest Festival in Austin. And that's what most people know South by Southwest for music and for film as well. But it's also one of the most creative tech conferences in the United States. Here to talk about that is our Takeaway Tech contributor, host of Popular Science's Future of, Baratunde Thurston. He joins us from the airport. Actually, Baratunde, you're about to catch a flight to Austin for the festival, right?
Yes, I am. I'm on a JetBlue flight, and they were nice enough to find me a relatively quiet spot in the airport. So good to be here, and good to be back. Thanks.
So tell me about the South by Southwest Festival. What kind of technological innovations have come out of this festival?
Well, I think the first thing people need to understand is that, you know, because this festival happens in the context of the better-known film and music fest, South by Southwest Interactive, which is what the tech component is called, is just more creative. You have web designers, you have software developers, you have just a few business people relative to the overall audience, and not so much in the terms of hardware like you'd find at the Consumer Electronics Show. So it's just a different sort of slightly more artistic and creative state of mind. So one of the services that really blew up at South by a few years ago, and people who go call it South by because it's not short enough to say South by Southwest, is Twitter. You know, Twitter was developed not there, didn't launch there, but it certainly made its first mark there. And you get a lot of these, you know, digital, you know, digerati type people come to Austin, Texas, this hub of activity and culture, and then fling back out across the world and take what they've learned back to their businesses, to their campuses, to their organizations, and sometimes to their homes.
So, I mean, the South by Southwest, as you're describing, is a more kind of technological, maybe philosophical, creative sort of platform. What kind of things will be coming out this year? If it's not hardware and not technically software, what is it?
Well, one of the big battles now that so many people have smart mobile phones, and it's still not the majority, but it's growing. It's one of the few growing areas in electronics. Location is a big deal. As I like to say, location is communication. So the ability to share your location with trusted parties, with your family, with your friends, in a slightly more passive way than calling them or explicitly texting them, I'm over here. You know, we often wonder how we were ever able to coordinate meeting folks before cell phones came along, because we couldn't call and say, no, I'm to the left, I'm to the right, you know, two blocks north. Well, imagine something even more efficient than that, where you simply, you know, whip out your phone, ping, I'm right here, and it knows the venue you're at, it knows how many other people who are your friends are nearby. So two companies, one called Foursquare, which is based in New York, and one called Gowalla, based in Austin, are going to kind of be battling it out for supremacy in this location space.
Also sounds like a really good way to locate your child if they get lost at Disneyland. But, you know, let me ask you about what you'll be talking about at the festival. You have a talk coming up that's called How to Be Black. Does it seem like people need to instructions how to do that, Baratunde?
You know, everybody wants to be it, but nobody really wants to be it. I'm happy to be a part of a series called Future 15, and they're attempting to bring, you know, some diverse perspectives to the area of technology. So the title is a bit tongue-in-cheek, but I'm going to be talking about black people on the internet and on the social web, especially. You know, you don't hear often in the press examples of who's using Facebook or how is MySpace still relevant, where's SMS going and text messaging, and who's using Twitter. And one of the interesting things I note is that of the trending topics on a service like Twitter, so many of them come right out of, you know, current black culture and are driven by black users on Twitter. It's sort of a big secret that Twitter is possibly very disproportionately African-American versus the perception that people have. So I'll be making some fun observations like that, getting into a little bit of statistics, and, of course, having you know, a laugh or two.
So maybe whites are the minority among Twitter users, which brings us to our takeaway question, Baratunde.
Yeah.
Thurston, we're asking people today, as the demographics change, I'm wondering, let me ask you the same question we're asking listeners. How, in what ways are you a minority, and in what ways do you think of yourself as a majority?
Well, you know, I had an encounter with someone on the street earlier, and she didn't even have Google Maps on her phone, and I realized that, you know, everyone in this space going to South by Southwest Interactive is a minority relative to certainly global society and even the average American citizen. So it's worth it for all of us to keep that in mind as we get these pie-in-the-sky visions of this great future, that we have to make sure to share, you know, all that efficiency and all that wealth with the rest of our folks.
Technology nerds, a minority. Baratunde Thurston is a Takeaway Tech contributor on his way to the South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas. Thanks, Baratunde.
Thank you.
So here on the show, we always think at about this time of the week, who's having a good week or who's having a bad week. Go to thetakeaway.org and look back at who's had a bad week or a good week with our friends, The Week magazine. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.